From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Millions of Americans say that physical pain has become a regular part of their lives. According to the National Institutes of Health, 25 million people report experiencing pain every day for the previous 3 months, and most of them say it was a lot of pain. And yet, even with this widespread struggle, our guest today says the medical system is itself struggling with how best to help these patients, especially given huge concerns today about opioid addiction. We're talking this hour on The Exchange with Dr. David Nagel, a Concord-based physician and author of the new book, Needless Suffering, How Society Fails Those with Chronic Pain. And let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange@nhpr.org, find us on Facebook or Twitter, and Dr. Nagel, welcome, it's nice to meet you.
Thank you, nice to meet you.
Well, that's a pretty big statement, how society has failed people with chronic pain. How has society done that, and who in particular, Dr. Nagel, from society has failed these patients?
I think it's all of us, actually. Part of it's perception, a lot of it's perception. We have an idea of what it means to be in pain. And sometimes our perceptions are really harmful to others. I don't know if you want to hear an example already.
I'd love to hear an example.
All right. A couple of years ago, I was on grand jury duty, and there was a very imposing sheriff watching over me as I was sequestered from everybody else because I knew what was going on, and a lot of the cases were about opioid issues. And he looked at me and he started and he didn't know I was a pain doctor. He didn't know I was a doctor at all. And he started shaking his finger and he goes, those doctors, he used an expletive before doctors. He goes, they're harming everybody and those patients need to learn to suck it up like everybody else does. And he was obviously oblivious that people have not been sucking it up for years. They've been using cannabinoids and opioids and alcohol and sharpened stones and porcupine quills and miscellaneous other things to try to treat their pain for years, totally under the radar. But the next day, I went to work, and I had another policeman come and see me with an acute herniated disc with horrible pain radiating down his leg. And he just looks at me, and the first words out of his mouth was, he goes, I never, ever believed anybody till it happened to me. I will never question anybody's pain ever again. And I think the point is, the first guy never really understood what the second group of people is going through. And so it's easy to have this perception till you go through it. And
Stigmatizes.
Exactly, exactly. And that's the word we use, is you're stigmatizing a whole group of people. And they frequently, contrary to popular belief, suffer in silence. My mom, I write about in my book, and she had horrible pain, I assume, from a rheumatoid arthritis. And the reason I say assume is that she felt it was not a good idea to tell the rest of us about it. So until very late in her life, and she knew I was a doctor, she knew I was doing this, she never even talked to me about it. And I was totally oblivious to it. And the more I do this, the more people I talk to, the more I realize that this is really common, that people do suffer in silence.
So all of us fail people in chronic pain. Your average person who says, suck it up. What about doctors? What about insurers? What about the health system, you know, writ large?
I should take a step back because, I mean, any story has heroes and villains. I mean, there's wonderful people out there that are from all sorts of, all walks of white life, you know, that really, you know, acknowledge these are issues and come forward and help people. But then on the other side, there's people that don't. Like, for example, you know, have an injured worker. And some companies are wonderful. They say, you know, you've got pain. We'll do whatever we need to do to help get you back here. And that's so reassuring. And then you have other companies that, you know, you're really screwing our bottom line and you're, you know, a bad person and all that. And then they go to the court system, which treats them as often guilty until proven innocent. It's a really stressful thing. And I mean, I go on and on. But as far as, you know, physicians are concerned, what's striking to me, and this is a very long story as well, but as to why things are, I think, the way they are. But these are challenging patients for physicians. And as we move along in our healthcare reform, which I believe is not just a short-term thing, but it's something that's been going on for decades. As time has gone on, our time to spend with patients gets less and less. They become more stressful, and you're trying to fit somebody with a complex problem, biopsychosocial, into a 10-minute visit, and you have to satisfy the needs of the computer in five of those 10 minutes. Meaningful use, which is another great thing that's designed to take our care away from our patients and look at the public as a whole. All of a sudden, you have no time to really listen to this patient's needs. And I have so many patients say, you know, he was with me 10 minutes and he never heard a word I said. And I look at him, I said, you know, part of the problem is he has to palliate the needs of others. And you're kind of losing out in that battle. It's not cool to go into pain management as pain management should be these days, because pain management is time consuming. When I was doing it formally, I would spend an hour with a patient the first visit just getting to know them, because you need to know them, know what makes them tick and things like that.
Well, and that gets to that word that I definitely want you to define, Dr. Nagel. You and a lot of experts in this field today call pain a biopsychosocial issue, and you just use that word. So what does that mean?
I'm going to expand that to biopsychosocial spiritual, because I was yelled at by somebody for ignoring the spiritual. But so it's all four things, and I'm honored to say that I went to med school at the University of Rochester totally because George Engel was there, and George was the father of the biopsychosocial model of medicine. If you look at a lot of the really neat writings from the Holocaust and places like that where people really suffered, like Viktor Frankl wrote a book about that, his experience, and he said the most important thing in anybody's life is what gives them meaning. That's what allows them to go through a lot of stress. And so meaning in our life is quite variable, from our psychological function to our social function to just how our bodies work. And so George felt that every illness was a manifestation of all three elements. So in other words, you know, if I hurt my back at home, it might not be that stressful, but I do it at work and I'm risking losing my job and so on and so forth. All of a sudden, there's a psychological element because I can't function, do the things that I wanted to do. And so all that has meaning in terms of how I respond to what I'm going through. And George felt it was really important. I feel like I should call him Dr. Engel. But anyways, he always told us that you have to understand the whole of the person to really understand how that illness affects them.
So bio meaning the physical part, psycho meaning how it affects their psychology, and social, how it affects their relationship with other people and the world. All of a sudden you're in pain, you can't go out anymore, you're not as much fun as you used to be.
Right.
People say, I don't want to call Laura on the phone. All she does is complain. You know, so that's what you're talking about.
Right. And the spiritual fits into that, too. And I, for example, we're seeing a lot of patients from other countries these days. And the meaning of illness to them can be really striking. Like I had one guy that, you know, he had a minor tear of his Achilles tendon. You know, it was something that really, it shouldn't bother anybody. But in his culture, that was punishment for some misdeed of some sort, as they would sever your Achilles tendon. So when he had torn it, he thought by God he was being punished for something, and he was totally inconsolable. And it, until I really understood what was going on with him, it was hard for me to understand his reaction.
And how do you discern that in 10 minutes?
You don't. You don't. I mean, it took me, he was an inpatient because I was treating him for something else, but you don't. You really don't. I mean, you're just, especially in chronic pain, folks, we know, and some people say, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but we know that people with chronic pain have a history, at least a substantial percentage, of having been physically, sexually, psychologically abused at some point in their life.
And it manifests itself into physical pain.
Not really. What it does is it changes the way their neurophysiology processes pain. So, but you're not going to learn that in a 10-minute visit if you've never met the person. And I get a kick out of it because some pain docs will give you a survey to fill out. Have you ever been psychologically, sexually, or physically abused? And I say, oh, sure, I'm going to check that off. And I don't even know this guy, and I don't even know if I can trust him. I mean, my experience was until they trust me, they're not going to tell me that. And it's so rare that they'll tell you that on the first visit, and definitely not in 10 minutes.
So is it fair to say, Dr. Nagel, that, you know, doctors are under pressure, 10 minutes, 15 minutes with a patient, especially when in chronic pain, you know, it's ongoing and you can't figure it out, And yet you have this biopsychosocial spiritual issue. 10 minutes to figure it out. You don't figure it out. So you, the doctor, throw opioids at a person. Is that what's going on?
I don't think it's that simple. I think that's what we do for everything. You know,
you throw a pill at it.
I don't think that's a new thing. I think that's been going on for a very long time. I mean, as an acupuncturist in my previous lifetime, I mean this life, but a couple years ago, I mean, you know, we would throw herbs at people. Well, I don't know what that does, but somebody told me to do it and somebody makes them feel better. But doctors have been doing it forever, you know, like Valium in the 60s, Prozac in the 80s. I remember when I was working in the orthopedic clinic in the 70s, everybody got butazolidine and things like that.
I mean, don't even know what that is.
It's an old anti-inflammatory. It was kind of toxic, so we decided it was a good idea to stop using it. But it was one of the first anti-inflammatories, like ibuprofen and things like that. But it was a new thing for those guys, so everybody got it. You know, the opioid thing is kind of an old new thing. I'm not sure how much in depth you want to go on the history of this, but the history is important. Because
well, let's go into the history of it because it is important and it's so much talked about today. Mm-hmm. And as you said, and I just said, docs are often fairly or unfairly blamed for this opioid addiction crisis, all the overdoses and deaths we're seeing. Let me also remind our listeners, though, Dr. Nagel, that they can join us. The phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. We're digging into a lot today in the exchange with Dr. David Nagel about his new book called Needless Suffering, How Society Fails Those with Chronic Pain. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. Find us on Twitter. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So, yes, Dr. Nagel, the history of opioid use, it is important. People think this is new. It is not new.
No,
it goes back, well, who knows how many years, but in this country, maybe 100 years ago at least.
Yeah. I do want to take a step back since I am here to talk about the book. And to be honest, I reluctantly put a chapter on opioids in the book. I really feel that the whole conversation distracts us from the underlying problem, which is a lot bigger. And if opioids are the only part of pain management, then that's a problem in perception that needs to be changed. But it's still obviously an important problem because, unfortunately, opioids have the potential to help people with pain, but they also have the potential to harm those with addiction. So it creates a social conundrum. And as you said, it's not a new thing. In the United States, really, the first big opioid epidemic or heroin epidemic or whatever was in the late 1800s. And it was kind of, I mean, to look at the history of it, it's a little bit comical in a sense because risk takers are young adolescent males. And it seems that there's a preponderance of young adolescent males that get involved with this. And the problem for a culture that's at risk, you know, war-wise or whatever, is that those young adolescent males, the guy's going to have to fight for you. So in the late 1800s, when heroin addiction became a big thing and public policy was run primarily by the states, was that something they felt needed to be done because they were losing fighting-age guys. So in 1906, the federal government got involved and started regulating it. The other thing that was simultaneous, though, was this theory in medicine that stimulating people was good for illness and opioids were a good stimulus. So everybody got an opioid.
Wow. So you sort of had two cross currents working against each
exactly.
other there.
And what was kind of neat thing was by the early 1900s, people realized, the doctors were starting to realize, this isn't the panacea that we thought it was. You know, everybody wants an easy fix, and it wasn't the easy fix, and it had adverse consequences. So in addition to recreational addiction, there was also iatrogenic or doctor-caused addiction. So
that's what people say we're seeing now, doctor-caused addiction.
Yeah, and I will say we have a simultaneous problem with both over and under prescription. And the history, though, that created that was that by 1914, they passed a law called the Harrison Act. And basically it was supposed – and the reason why it's important is because you know, you don't want to make the same mistakes you made in the past with public policy, and that's my concern is what I'm seeing happen now. But what that law said was, yeah, opioids are good, but if you prescribe them too long as a physician, that can be bad, and you could be liable to criminal prosecution. Which
that sounds just like today.
Exactly. And it was, like, really frightening for doctors. But the thing that made it even worse was the subsequent Supreme Court look at the law where they expanded that to say, well, maintenance for addicts is also bad. So all of a sudden, if you're a pain patient, you can't find a doctor who will treat your pain with opioids. And the way the doctors started looking at them as people with a character flaw rather than somebody with a legitimate illness. But the other thing is they looked at addicts as criminals. And so all of a sudden now it's a crime to be an addict. And if you're a patient in pain, you have no resources. So where do they go? I call it the Jean Valjeanization of medicine, is these people go to
from
the
Les
streets.
Miserables. Yeah.
Yeah, they go to the streets to get their stuff. And now they're committing a crime, and we call that pseudo-addiction. They're not really addicted. They're totally logically trying to do anything they can do to help themselves. And we're seeing the same thing now with both opioids and cannabinoids. But by the mid-early 60s, people started to realize that addiction was a medical problem. By the 80s, we were realizing that opioids did have we needed to come with a better balance of how we prescribed opioids. The problem was is the way that it got PR'd to the doctors was, yeah, opioids aren't that bad after all. We can just prescribe them liberally.
Well, let me ask you about that, too. And again, the whole book is not about opioids. It's about, as you say, how society fails those with chronic pain. And there's a lot to talk about there. But since we're on this now, Dr. Nagel, when these addiction rates, you know, start rising and overdoses and deaths here in New Hampshire and elsewhere in northern New England, people did turn to doctors and say, you guys are overprescribing, you know, you're being careless, you're not paying attention. Now, some are shifting their attention to the pharmaceutical companies saying these were oversold as miracle drugs and their addictive qualities were underplayed.
See, I don't really agree with that because I was actually involved in the early stages of a lot of this. So I know exactly what was happening is that, you know, the first question is the addiction rate really rising or are people just shifting from one drug to another? And I've asked that. I'm not an addiction expert, so I'm not going to say I know the answer to that personally, but I have asked addiction experts and their answer was, we don't know. The problem is they're shifting to a dangerous drug.
A drug that is more likely to kill you.
Exactly.
Like fentanyl.
Exactly. And so, you know, the death rate rises, and because the availability of these drugs on the street is dramatically increased because of the increasing prescription, it's more available. Addicts follow the law of economics. If it's available and it's cheap, that's what they'll do. And so that's probably what's leading to that. So the two things are kind of parallel, if that makes sense. But it's not, you know, then the cause and effect, that's another leap to make. But I can't help but say, yeah, doctors are somewhat involved in this. And I think as far as the drug companies were concerned, you know, I worked with one of them a little bit. I wasn't one of the big guys involved, but they never minimized the risk of addiction. They said the risk exists, but it's – and they were right. It's not as bad as what they say. There's a certain percentage of people – In the human population that are at risk for addiction, there's a certain percentage that have no risk, and then there's a large group in the middle. So if you their point was that if you monitor these things closely, that you can control the risk.
Coming up, I'll ask Dr. Nagel what purpose pain serves in the body, and we'll talk more about the many themes in his book, Needless Suffering, How Society Fails Those with Chronic Pain. More in a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with Dr. David Nagel. He's a Concord physician and authored the new book called Needless Suffering, How Society Fails Those with Chronic Pain. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Your own experiences, questions, comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dr. Nagel, let's just step back for a second. What purpose does pain serve?
Pain's a signal. I mean, we're talking about two separate things. We're talking about acute pain and chronic pain. So acute pain is a signal. It tells you something is wrong in theory.
You slipped a disc in your back.
Or something like
that. You sprained your knee.
And you need to do something about it.
And then that's a good thing.
It is a good thing. And it's probably a bad thing to ignore it. We see what happens to boxers and NFL players when they spend a whole career ignoring their pain and then have to deal with the ramifications the rest of their lives and then die young, you know, which a lot of them are doing. So it does serve a purpose. You need to acknowledge it. That's a good thing. Kind of like fire is a good thing. But a fire that controls goes out of control is a bad thing. So the way I like to think about it, and if Roger, you're listening, he asked me this question and I never answered it. So Roger, I'm going to answer it now if you're listening. Basically, think of it as a warning signal in your car, you know, tells you something's wrong. So you go, you know, acknowledge it, like the oil needs to be changed.
The light goes on the dashboard.
Exactly. So, well, what if you change the oil and the light stays on? Are you going to keep changing the oil? I mean, at some point, the signal becomes the problem. And that's what chronic pain is. And that's kind of what the difference is. It's a signal that's no longer serving a useful purpose. But unfortunately, you know, it gives you, unlike a lot of other signals in our body, like, for example, fibromyalgia is an interesting condition because most fibromyalgia, it's basically a global problem with sensory perception. So in other words, we have filters in our nervous system that are supposed to filter out information that's useless. You know, at some point pain's useful, at some point it's not. That information should be filtered out. We call it a diffuse noxious inhibitory control, DNIC. You have to give it an algorithm. So the problem is it's not the only sensory perception that's not filtered out. People with fibromyalgia generally can hear things other people can't hear. They smell things other people can't smell and so on and so forth.
That's overwhelming.
But the only part they attend to is the pain. And I find that fascinating. And until I mention that to people with fibromyalgia, they're totally unaware of it. So pain is an unpleasant thing, and it really substantially changes your quality of life, your enjoyment of life, smelling, you know, food a little bit easier than everybody else doesn't really change things quite as much.
How do you sort out then, Dr. Nagel, patients who, well, you said pain is a signal that something's wrong in the body. So how do you feel about it when people say, I shouldn't mask my pain because it's a signal? I need to experience this pain so that I can figure out what's going on?
Well, one thing we know is there's a balance.
How do you find that?
Well, we used to use a thing in cardiac rehab called the Borg scale, where you basically rate, you know, the intensity of what you're experiencing and don't let it go beyond a certain amount.
Sure.
So we know for a fact that passivity is bad. You know, like, for example, if I hurt my knee and I lay in bed all day, that's a bad thing. So you want to keep moving to some degree. So you have to acknowledge your pain, but don't let it limit you excessively. The problem is that's a moving target and it's different for everybody.
Right. So it's hard for us to use your words from earlier. How do you help people sort out what they should, quote unquote, suck up and
correct.
When they should come to you and say, you know, doc, I need something?
That's correct. And most people in my experience will try to suck it up for a long time before they go to a doctor. And that can be a problem sometimes, too. I mean, we like to believe, you know, it's a great thing. I have a lot of things I can blame people for so that I don't have to take responsibility. Like, you know, you're either too fat, it's a psychological problem, or if you'd only come to see me 2 months ago, I would have been able to cure you, which is probably nonsense, but it makes me feel better about myself and you not so good about yourself. But yeah, finding that happy balance is kind of a challenge.
So in the book, Dr. Nagel, you say that doctors are in some sense responsible for this, I don't know if I can call it an epidemic of chronic pain. You know, they only have 10 minutes. Maybe that's the insurance company's fault. But the doctors sort of stigmatize and they don't take it seriously or they don't want to deal with it. And then there's the insurers who, you know, maybe don't pay for the physical therapy or, you know, whatever else this patient may need. What about, though, you're kind of hitting on this, what about the patients themselves with chronic pain who don't lose weight, who don't see a mental health practitioner, who, you know, drink too much or smoke too much? I mean, how do you suss out the level of responsibility for the patient in chronic pain?
Well, I think you know, the first step is to learn to understand the person, you know, what they're dealing with.
That biopsychosocial, exactly. Spiritual issue that you have 10 minutes to figure out.
Because I remember when I was a resident, I always take the younger med students out, and I would sit there, and we would go on a chalkboard and write down biological, psychological, social, functional. We'd write down all their issues. And then based on that, then you go back and create, well, this is what I think needs to happen. The reason why I started writing the book was, you know, you can do that all you want. But if they have an environment outside of them that's telling them that they're no good, that's creating unnecessary stress, well, how do you affect that? So then I realized that the interdisciplinary team that we like to call it, the group of professionals that are trying to help this person adapt, is a lot broader than I initially envisioned. And for me to make a difference, I need to affect all these other people too, like their job, their family, the guy on the street who calls them names, their workplace, the lawyers, the public policymakers. They're all part of the entire team. And I found that if like one person says the wrong thing, they can screw up everything for everybody. And I've seen this happen over and over to patients whose lives are ruined just because one person out of many did the wrong thing.
So how often do you think physical pain is a manifestation of a mental health issue?
That's a really tough question.
Because the CDC talks about this in their recent guidelines.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a cart and a horse type issue. We do know, for example, years ago, there's a thing called the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. It's a psychological test. Some guy observed that there's three scales, hypochondriasis, depression, and hysteria, I think they were. And if you looked at them, they made a characteristic V when you would connect the dots. So he said, well, those people that have a characteristic V are more likely to have chronic pain. Turned out that was wrong, that once you develop chronic pain, and the few people that they'd actually done this before they develop pain, the V ends up after you've developed the pain. So the pain creates the psychological duress.
And sure, which makes sense.
Total,
right?
Sense.
If you're in pain and you can't do the things you want to do, you can't socialize, you can't get outside, of course you're going to have some mental distress.
You know, the best thing I ever do to anybody, I do a lot of spinal injection for pain, which is another long story. But anyway, so one of the best things I can do, which is really sad at the same time, is like periodically my needle gets in their spinal fluid and occasionally people get a spinal headache after. And I think everybody should watch the patient's face before they get that headache, when they get the headache, and then I can do something to get rid of it and after. And it is so amazing to see how a relatively normal person, it's Van Gogh-like, can be totally, their face totally distorted, almost unrecognizable. You don't even know it's the same person. And then I put a little bit of blood in their epidural space. It seals the hole. Their headache goes away very quickly. And all of a sudden, they're back to the way they were before. And then you realize what effect pain has on the mentation, psychological function, you know, of an individual. It's an incredible lesson because, unfortunately, as a doctor, you don't often get to see what the person looked like before they had the pain. And so you don't know that person. You just know the person with the pain.
Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, it's a discussion with Dr. David Nagel about his brand new book, Needless Suffering, How Society Fails Those with Chronic Pain. Dr. Nagel is a specialist in physical medicine, rehabilitation, and pain management at Concord Orthopedics, and he's New Hampshire's representative to the American Academy of Pain Medicine. And let's hear from you some of these big issues that we're digging into with Dr. Nagel. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And first up is Lee in Keene. Hi, Lee. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange. Welcome.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
I tuned in a little bit late, but just in time to hear Dr. Nagel speak about the Holocaust survivor. Just someone's trying to call me. I've got to give them a message here. Sorry. About a psychological physical relationship. And when I was 38, I ruptured a disc in my back. And I was contemplating surgery. I actually was referred to Dr. Fager at the Leahy Clinic. And I used a local osteopath to help me moderate or just interpret a lot of the information I had. And I had a CAT scan confirmed rupture at L5-S1. And a friend of mine, my neighbor of mine, who was a psychologist, referred me to a doctor in New York by the name of John Sarno at the Rusk Institute, who's written several books. One is called Mind Over Back Pain, and the other one is Healing Back Pain, and his most recent one is called The Divided Mind.
So, Lee, is your question about the link between, you know, your mental health or spiritual health and your back health? Is that what you're getting at?
Well, I'm going to – just give me a moment, please, Laura. So I went to – my insurance at the time paid for this treatment. I drove to New York. I met with Dr. Sarno, and his theory, when he found the symptoms of my body, said, yes, you've got it. And he has a thing called tension meiosis syndrome. And he said, what you're doing is putting your emotion in your body and creating pain to distract you from your negative emotion.
You know, we should definitely talk about this. Thank you so much, Lee. We touched on it earlier, but there is a connection, you say in the book, between your emotional, spiritual state and your pain. But yeah, I have another follow-up for you there, but go ahead, Dr. Nagy.
I think it's real. I mean, I'm very familiar with Dr. Sarno's work. The tension myalgia thing is actually something that came out of the Mayo Clinic, but I think it's the problem with the way it came out of the Mayo Clinic was that they said that, well, basically all this tension, like you're saying, is psychological in origin, and that's really not true. It's much more complicated than that. It's very dangerous, I think, sometimes to infer causes and effects, because we know that psychological techniques like Dr. Sarno recommends can be very helpful in helping people manage their pain. There's also a timing element to this. I have a chapter in the book called The Neurophysiology and the Psychology of Pain Moving Targets. They're always changing, and your ability to accept what the information he's providing or to find it helpful is going to be quite variable depending upon where you are in the course of your pain. And I'm not saying that it's not helpful, but I think it's a great oversimplification of a really complex problem. And I don't want to say he doesn't help people. He definitely does. And we use the techniques that he uses or similar ones. I mean, cognitive behavioral therapy is kind of thought to be the best kind of psychological therapy to treat chronic pain, which kind of does the same type of thing he's doing. So what he's saying has value, but I think it's dangerous to make that assertion. It's much more complicated than that.
So is the danger that if you say to someone, you know, this is oversimplifying, but the pain's partly in your head, then do you draw a line saying, you know, it's your fault you're in pain?
Right.
And if you, and I'm quoting from your book, if you didn't have a screw loose,
right,
language from your book, you wouldn't have this pain. I mean, it's tricky, isn't it? Because there undoubtedly is, based on your book and the research, that there is a link between, sometimes, between mental and physical pain. Obviously,
correct,
if you break your leg, you know, because you get hit by a car, that's not a mental health issue. But it's tough, isn't it, to make the connection there without saying, you know, it's all your fault, it's all in your head.
One of the points that I make a lot in the book is that we assume that as doctor, and again, I don't want to be blaming doctors all the time. I think you do the best with what you have. But the problem is when you think you have more than you have.
What do you mean by that?
So, you know, a lot of people think, well, we have these wonderful diagnostic tools and we can figure out the cause for everybody's pain. So by definition, if we can't figure out the cause, then it's a psychological problem.
I see. So our MRIs, like, our CAT scans, our X-rays don't show anything. Therefore, David Nagel, you know, you've got to screw loose.
And we know that's not true. And I mean, I created one of the, I believe, one of the first clinics in the world to treat post-concussive syndrome or minor, we called it minor traumatic brain injury back in the late 80s. And the only reason I started doing it was I was, you know, my specialty is physical medicine. I deal with head injured people. And I was seeing all these people with supposedly minor head injury who have their lives turned upside down. And when we started doing neuropsych testing on them and seeing how screwed up they were, excuse my French, screwed up, you know, we realized there's a real problem here. When 10 people walk into your office with the same loose screw,
which seemed like a minor head injury, now we know the brain was
right,
shaken, and there's huge repercussions
and
from
that.
And
it's so funny because they called it litigation neurosis. And I was getting all these patients that had no litigation. So I go, well, it can't be litigation neurosis.
What does litigation neurosis mean?
It means that
you're desperate for a lawsuit?
Basically, that's what it means. And
very dismissive.
Well, my favorite one was I took a patient went to court and I had to defend him. And the way I defended him was really sad. He's standing on the trial with all these symptoms. So I come in, I open up this book. And unbeknownst to them, I had a magazine stuffed in the book, and I'm reading off his symptoms and saying that this is what this person has. And I open it, shut it, and I say, I'm reading from the medical journal of Sports Illustrated, and I was reading Warren Moon's and Al Toon's symptoms after concussions that they got.
From the NFL.
The NFL. It was the exact, and this was 1993. It was the exact same symptoms this patient was having. So all of a sudden, well, Jock's got it, must be real. You know,
and then people started taking it seriously and not calling your patients sort of desperate to get money for a lawsuit.
The tension myalgia stuff's dangerous because people then jump to say it's psychologic, and that's what the Mayo Clinic was doing, and that's why it's dangerous.
Well, Lee and Keene, thank you again for the call. Big point there. And then the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, 1-800-892-6477. Jerry's in Freedom. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air with Dr. David Nagel. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I wanted to respond back to some of that question about sort of where the blame lies. And I think it's not so much blame, but sort of how we got there.
Sure.
One of the things about this, in terms of the role of the physicians, you have to remember that physicians will respond to what they're, you know, the information that comes out from what we like to call thought leaders, the people who are important in the field that tell them what really is going on. And if we look at how this all evolved, the role of the drug companies in terms of pushing these was really rather pervasive. It wasn't just that salesman that came in and talked to you in the office, but you also had a very strong and solid push to get number of thought leaders involved to say these things. And we saw the recommendations by the American College of Physicians and the American Pain Society. Oh, I should say I'm a retired spine physician. That's why I'm kind of into this. But those particular organizations who strongly suggested that we would treat chronic non-cancer pain with opioid therapy.
So you're saying, Jerry, and I'll let you go on, but you're saying that doctors were sold a bill of goods from the opioid companies.
Well, but through... In a sense, some of organized medicine, if you will, I hate to use that phrase because it sounds rather pejorative. But what I mean is they were told that these drugs were quite good. And yet those two, the American Pain Society and American Physicians who joined together on a board to look at this, most of those people were conflicted with ties to industry. And an even more striking example was in 2008, all of us who were registered physicians here in this state sent a book by the New Hampshire Board of Registration in Medicine called Responsible Opioid Prescribing by Dr. Scott Fishman. And we were told how this was a great manual to refer to for what we could do. And in here, as I began to read it, I found great difficulty because he made, for example, a strong statement that it's proven to use opioids in chronic pain from non-cancer origin, which that proof was not there. But if we look at the book, it was sponsored by a consortium of drug companies. It took me less than a minute on Google to find out that this particular physician was on was a paid consultant and on the speaker bureau for Cephalon, Elon, Endo, Janssen.
And Jerry, I'm going to let you go, but I'm so glad you called because, Dr. Nagel, after the break, I'm going to ask you about the role of so-called experts and so forth, as Jerry mentions. And Jerry, sorry to cut you off there. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're digging into a new book by Concord Dr. David Nagel. It's called Needless Suffering, How Society Fails Those with Chronic Pain. Let's hear from you on this topic. Call in 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dr. Nagel, just before the break, we heard from Jerry, a doctor himself, who feels like so-called experts, you know, we don't need to go into all the names, but so-called experts told doctors, these are good. And now so-called experts are telling doctors, these are bad.
I'm not sure that's what they're saying. One of the things that I think is, you know, it's important to say what, because he's not wrong. When this whole movement started and Russ Portnoy's name got associated with, he's from Sloan Kettering. If you listen to what he said still has validity. He said opioids are not for everybody, but he said it's wrong to say they're not right for anybody and that there is a small percentage of people that opioids with chronic pain can be of benefit to. The other thing that him and Kathleen Foley were big with was for end-of-life care, because we were saying they were bad for people with end-of-life, too. This was in the mid-'80s, and this is when I started my practice. And that observation led to a whole new way of looking at opioids. And I don't think, and you referred to Scott Fishman, I don't think that they were saying it was a panacea or that it was for everybody, but that it was an option and there was a right way and a wrong way to do it.
Sure, and that's what the New Hampshire Board of Medicine has been trying to sort through. Don't, you know, throw them out completely, but look more carefully at who's getting them and who isn't.
One of the sad things I think in retrospect was, you know, I was involved in writing the first set of law rules for opioid prescribing in the state, and one thing that never happened, we wanted to have happen, was to educate people, opioid, not just physicians, but the public about the good and the bad, and how to find a balance in prescribing. And I think that's what the medical board's doing right now.
Well, actually, I got an email sort of towards that effect. This is from Siri, who says, as an RN working in the hospital setting for the past 36 years, wow, Siri, I feel strongly that the spike in the abuse or dependence on pain medication began to escalate when the Joint Commission that accredits hospitals added a fifth vital sign called pain. Basically, what they said was that a patient's right is to be pain-free. Siri says, I feel this opened Pandora's box leading to what we are seeing today. Siri, so good to hear from you based on your long experience. What do you think, Dr. Nagel?
You are totally right. I work with a lot, you know, the groups that I'm involved with in terms of the support for my book and who I wrote it for. My book is written on behalf of patients directed to all these other people, but I meet with these consumer advocacy groups, and I sat in the middle of one of them once, and I said the worst thing that ever happened to pain management was that fifth vital sign because it created unrealistic expectations. And every person in that, I mean, you have to realize these are really people with chronic pain. They're all heads of organizations and they've learned to adapt and things like that. But they all agreed with me. Every one of them said it was correct that, you know, the perception that we can get rid of everybody's pain. And I get in trouble for this. I've had a couple people tell me I'm wrong, but I'm not. Most chronic pain we cannot get rid of. And that fifth vital sign was a bad thing. And I think you're exactly right. The minute we you know, the only treatment we really have for chronic pain is opioids, and we have other things too, but we don't have a lot of options, and there's a thing called the National Pain Strategy, which if you've got nothing better to do, there's a million petitions out there right now to sign and get President Obama to sign off on it, but it was something that we've been involved with for a very long time to change the way we as a culture perceive, judge, and most importantly, treat pain, because there's virtually no attention paid to finding alternative strategies to treat pain.
Well, hang on. So go back to what you said a minute ago, where you said we can't treat all chronic pain. We shouldn't expect chronic pain to go away. That's very disheartening to hear. Shouldn't that be a goal, Dr. Nagel? I mean, think of the productive capacity and the happiness quotient if people weren't living in chronic
pain. Well, we want to be cancer-free. We want to be heart disease-free. We want to be diabetes-free. We want to be pain-free. I mean, they're all like, they're pie-in-the-sky type goals. But right now, given what we know, the level of our technology, the level of our ability to even attend to the problem, the likelihood that we can cure chronic pain is not great. And our goal really with most of these patients is not necessarily to change. I mean, we like to lower your pain, eliminate it. It's a little bit much of a goal to expect. If you get rid of your pain, like I've had patients with migraines for years that get over it, that's wonderful. But it's the exception more than the rules. Our goal is help you adapt to your problem. And it's not to get rid of your hope for a better future, but at the same time, you got to attend to the present. And so that's our goal, is to functionally help people adapt and make their quality of life a lot better. Some people used to say putting your pain to the side,
easier said than done.
Well, a lot of people can do it, but it's not easy. To suggest that's easy is crazy, but...
Let's take another call, Dr. Nagel. And again, the number here in the exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, our guest is Dr. David Nagel. His book is Needless Suffering, How Society Fails Those with Chronic Pain. Marie's in Chester. Hi, Marie. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. And thank you, Dr. Nagel. My husband is an above-knee amputee and been that for 45 years. He suffers with horrible phantom pains. They've tried everything on him, the benzoids, the opioids, spinal injections, even though the MRI showed there's no impingement in the spine. I've tried, called everywhere. No one seems to treat phantom pain. He'll be up all night in horrible pain.
Oh, Marie, I'm so sorry.
So, do you know of anybody that deals with that?
Yeah, and phantom pain, I mean, we could probably talk about that for 15 minutes. But, boy, what a heartbreaking story.
I'm going to probably twist this around to a public policy issue. Everything you're seeing in terms of how medicine's changing as the years go on, we were talking about the 20-minute office visit became the 10-minute office visit, and what I call the Walmartization of medicine, where, you know, we went from being 70% of doctors being in private practice when I started, about 16% who were basically working for somebody else who tells them what to do. The pain management that you're looking for is a cost loser, a money loser. And what we're looking for to change is incentives for people to want to go into this field, to do the research, to do the teaching, to do the treatment, so on and so forth. So we
this field meaning pain management.
Pain management. And, I mean, mental health in general. They're both fields of medicine that are sorely lacking. And, you know, I'm a physiatrist. I went into physical medicine because I wanted to be a physiatrist. But there was no, you know, I don't want to say money, but there was no money in doing it. And even pain management, that was my whole first chapter book, my book. And the last chapter, asking the question, am I a coward? Because I believe certain things, but the the socioeconomic factors leads you into another direction. So the point is that trying to find a pain person or a pain management place that truly does pain management, and that's another long story.
Well, we've heard about some pain management places, pain clinics, where the practices are, you know, unscrupulous.
I'm not convinced that's a huge problem in New Hampshire. It certainly is in other places, but I don't think it's a big problem here. It's just, you know, you have to survive and you have to make a dollar. So, I mean, I had one of my friends who worked in a certain pain setting that was told that, you know, by corporate leadership, that he needs to spend more than 60% of his time doing procedural work because that pays and the counseling part doesn't. And I have a really good friend who's a psychiatrist who is wonderful counselor, was told that he won't get reimbursed for counseling, only for prescribing drugs. And all of a sudden, now you're funneling people to needles and drugs and away from other potential, you know, more broad biopsychosocial treatment approaches that supposedly don't pay well. So how do you make it pay well? You change the whole structure, basically.
So that's really interesting. So on one hand, it sounds like the medical professionals like yourself deeply understand that pain is a biopsychosocial, and again, to use your word, spiritual situation event. But the way that we pay for professionals like you to treat this very broad, complicated thing is backwards. It seems like you're recognizing how broad and complicated and time-consuming it is, but more and more the financial system, the financial side of healthcare, is saying quick, cheap, go, next person.
Yeah, and that's why I'm really frustrated. I'm a little bit reactionary about this. I have a sign on my wall that says throw the computer out the window. It has created some benefit, but it creates enormous cost and then I think false hopes too. I mean, there's a chapter or a section in the book where I talked about the computer and medicine and how it was sad that, you know, it was almost like the Bible or the altar in the Catholic Church in reverse. When I was a kid, the priest faced away from the congregation, then turned around and faced us because, you know, Vatican II, everything changed. Well, now as a doctor, we used to face the patient. Now we're facing the wall. I mean, I don't get it. And all these technological advances are absolutely wonderful, but if you're not addressing the needs or your abilities to do what you feel you need to do as a doctor being taken away by all these socioeconomic forces, then I think we seriously need to take a look at how we do things and try to find a balance there as well. And I feel bad we didn't really answer your question.
No, but. And Marie, I feel terrible about your husband. So, okay, so in the system that we're in today, that we've described. What can people like Marie's husband do?
Given
the way this is set up.
I mean, the theory is, you know, well, you can create centers of excellence. The VA system's kind of done that, you know, where, all right, not every hospital can treat this problem, but this one's really good at it. And I know that they're trying to make this more structural in various ways.
That's interesting. So you hear about different hospitals that are experts in cancer care or, orthopedics or whatever. Are there hospitals that specialize in pain?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, I mentioned Russ Portnoy's name earlier because the reason why I really like him is that I had a patient with a very complex problem, and I sent him to a Mecca, as we call them, places that supposedly have the answer. It's like Oz, the wizard has the answer
right.
for everything.
Are there pain Meccas?
I don't personally believe so, but I sent this patient to one of the local Meccas. I'll keep it on nameless. But anyway, so, you know, he came in and out, and they just kind of blew him off. And I was, like, really disenchanted because, as the previous caller was saying, you know, you have these experts that supposedly go to these meetings and tell you of all the answers to the problems. Well, anyway, so I sent the guy to Russ in New York, and Russ didn't help me or him any more than he said he didn't really understand the problem either. But he spent an hour and a half with the guy, and that was so valuable that I said, geez, if I could have every patient and send him to somebody like that, you know, that would be, you know, it has value to do that. Is that a Mecca? I don't know. But my concern is that when we send people to these supposed Meccas now, they're not getting the biopsychosocial care. They're getting, like you say, a drug, or they're getting needles. And I know the consumer advocacy group that I sat on, that's their big complaint. We don't want to be needled and drugged. We want to have self-treatments, things like that. Like the Arthritis Foundation used to do. They had a wonderful self-management program. Margaret Caudill used to have a great one in this state. We want those things back. They want power, control. That's what anybody wants. You want to be able to control your destiny to some extent.
And control your pain.
Yes, up to a point.
Let's take one last call if we could. And Elizabeth is in Wolfboro. Hi, Elizabeth, you're on The Exchange. Welcome. Thanks for calling in.
Hi there. First of all, great guest today. And secondly, I have both a personal and a professional experience with this. Professionally, I work with clients in all sorts of disorders with both their emotional and their physical circumstances for pain and anything else. I'm a movement educator and awareness educator for both. And I think that we're considerably underusing the whole field of body work because they do have the time to shift the perceptions.
Does body work mean, I'm sorry to interrupt, Elizabeth, but just to clarify, does body work mean physical therapy, yoga, massage?
No, whole,
what does that mean?
There are several hundred now kinds of body work, like massage and shiatsu and Traeger and including yogas and on. All of those touch and hands-on or energy work, they give you the time to address and also specifically will frequently address the entire bio, psyche, and social layers of this. And then on the for instance, to address the phantom pain, I had a colleague in Vermont who had a client whose two surgeons had agreed and cut off an arm with pain. He was referred to her, and he still had pain in his phantom arm,
sure.
which she was finally able to heal.
Elizabeth, I'm going to jump in just in the interest of time, and I do apologize for doing that to you, but I'm glad that you called. There's so much here, Dr. Nagel, mm-hmm. and there's so much we don't understand. I wonder what you think of Elizabeth's call.
Well, I think she brings up a valid point. It all comes down. I when I initially introduced myself to the Pain Action Alliance, I referred to myself as a hypocrite, and I said they wanted to know what we thought the problem in healthcare was, and I said it all comes down to money. What she's talking about is wonderful. These are all great treatments. They do help a lot of people. The problem with them is the research base is lacking. The evidence base is lacking. We have this incredible irrational belief in the evidence-based answer our questions. And to be honest, that's driving where the healthcare train is going right now. If you don't have an evidence base, nobody's going to pay for it. And so how do you change that? How do you get the system to pay for the wonderful things she's talking about? And I don't have a great answer, but I'm hoping the National Pain Strategy will help that.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you for calling in. And last question for you real quick, Dr. Nagel. Book just came out a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
What's been the reaction?
It's been humbling. I was expecting to get a lot of negative reactions and positive, but the reason we wrote the book initially was I shared a written catharsis with a former patient of mine, and she said that you were writing for us, you have to publish this. I had no intention of publishing anything. And so I'm getting a lot of feedback that people are saying, you know, you wrote this book for us, you're giving us a voice. And that really makes me feel good because that's kind of what I wanted to do.
Well, Dr. Nagel, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks.
Dr. David Nagel, again, his book is Needless Suffering, How Society Fails Those with Chronic Pain. Remember, this conversation always continues online, on Facebook, and at nhpr.org. This is The Exchange at NHPR.